I'd like to welcome Kathy Robinson, the Public Policy Director of WAND, which is the Women's Actions for New Directions. Could you tell me some history about WAND, Kathy?
We're called Women's Actions for New Directions now, but we were initially started as Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. And Dr. Helen Caldicott, of course, really was a key person who really made it very clear the direct and real impact of nuclear weapons, the effects that it would have, and her background as a medical doctor really helped to convey that very clearly to a number of people.
Now, she's still out there doing speeches. Is she still connected with you? Or how is that connection?
Well, she is no longer an active, she doesn't work directly with WAND any longer, but she certainly still continues to be part of the movement. She is living in Australia now, I believe, but she comes back frequently. She has family here and is very engaged still very much for nuclear disarmament and also on nuclear power issues.
You're the public policy director for WAND. What does that do and what brings you to that work?
I am, I guess, the lobbyist here in Washington. I coordinate our legislative work and the legislative strategy of the different components of our organization. In addition to a grassroots network of chapters and so forth, we also have a program of women state legislators. You know, coordinate the work of the folks out in the field and communicate that to our members on our members' message to the Hill.
In one of your news items, you had our local representative Lynn Woolsey when she was working on the Afghanistan war thing. I noticed that. Do you get to be involved with her?
We do some work with a number of different women, including Lynn Woolsey, and we're sad that she's retiring. She's had a great impact. I know she has a real presence on these issues of nuclear disarmament and sound budget priorities. We also work with a number of other women members of Congress, some who were part of our state legislator network before they came to Congress, and some who we've endorsed and helped to fund with our PAC, our WAND PAC. Hmm.
Is it a per se nonpartisan? How do you work that?
We work with women. It is nonpartisan, and what we're most interested in is women who are going to be working on the security issues that we care so much about. So. Mm-hmm. Making progress on reducing nuclear weapons and nuclear dangers and in reassessing our budget priorities so that we are shifting from funding excessive military spending to other human and environmental needs.
Right. Now, you work from grassroots up to trying to influence policymakers on nuclear disarmament. That's two very different hats. How do you move your head between, you know, those two camps?
Well, I mean, we just try to make the connection, and then a lot of the grassroots work is done at our chapter level and the local and state level, and our chapters have quite a lot of autonomy and do great things in the grassroots and are very involved in their communities, and then with our members, we really try to direct them to actions and that kind of thing that are directly related to influencing their members of Congress on these issues.
So how are the chapters set up? They all work under WAND? How do you work, or do you work with other groups that to give them that information?
We have several strong WAND chapters, and they are very active in their communities, like in Atlanta, Georgia, and Little Rock, Arkansas, two of our larger chapters. And then we also work with a number of partner organizations that have chapters and affiliates around the country as well. And then, you know, some members that are that aren't necessarily wanting to join a chapter locally, but are at least able and interested in responding to our email action alerts and doing some things on a sort of more ad hoc basis with us.
The WAND mission statement is, to empower women to act politically to reduce violence and militarism and redirect excessive military resources towards unmet human and environmental needs. You know, when you're looking at a military budget, how do you shift that, just in a global sense, to give a woman's slant to that?
Well, I mean, it is a sort of ambitious goal, but I think that women bring a lot of wisdom to this issue and understand that we have a variety of different budget priorities and that our federal budget in particular reflects who we are as a country and our moral values, and that we cannot afford to spend excessive amounts on military spending that doesn't make us more secure. And so, you know, I think then the tricky part is trying to go to members of Congress and convince them that they can do that, and working with our partner organizations that really care about the spending for the programs that are needed, like the programs to support the poor and elderly, to build the roads, to provide education, those kinds of things. To make those folks understand that you have to also look at the military budget, because so much of the money is going there. And if we can begin to get broader understanding about that, I think we can put some pressure on Congress so that we could make some changes, because there are certainly plenty of things that we know can be cut from the defense budget without harming our security. And we really need to shift the focus to that part of the discussion.
Now, in the military budget, are there specific, say in Iraq, say, as an example, is there specific money, say, to help women and children, or is it more just generalized, oh, we're going to build a new hospital or something, or a school? How is that dealt with on that nuts and bolts level?
Well, I think Iraq is an interesting example. Iraq and Afghanistan both. I think we've spent an enormous amount of money there in terms of the war, and we're happy that this month, you know, the troops are coming home from Iraq, and we are trying to speed up the process of them coming home from Afghanistan as well. But certainly, you know, as we leave both of those countries, we know that we're going to have to spend some money in terms of building a more sustainable peace and making those countries begin to find a way of sustainably moving forward with civil society. And that investment is much less expensive than the boots on the ground that we've paid for in blood and treasure. But it's still essential. And in fact, if we put more emphasis on that ahead of time in a lot of different places around the globe, then we would not be spending as much on these decades-long wars that really have no... We're trying to solve something that really has no way of... We have no way of winning a war. It requires a political solution.
Women in military, how do you work with them? Are things becoming equal per se, or is there still a long way to go in terms of bringing up that equality?
But women serving in the military?
Yeah.
You know, we don't really focus as much on that particular issue or aspect. Like in all other sectors, it's important to have women in the military and women rising to the leadership roles in the military. I will say that in this Obama administration, we've seen a lot of important women leaders in security positions. You know, not least, of course, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, but in a lot of the lower levels of the State Department, but very important in terms of some of the work that we've done specifically supporting the New START Treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia. The leadership for that treaty was really mostly women. Hillary Clinton, and then down to Rose Gottmuller, who was the lead negotiator on the START treaty, and Ellen Tauscher, who was also at the State Department and responsible for this area of arms control at the State Department. And she was formerly served in California as the House Armed Services Committee Strategic Committee Subcommittee Chair, which deals with the nuclear weapons and missile defense issues. I'm happy to say that there are increasingly a number of women who really are playing an important and significant role on making some of these decisions about how we spend our money and how we engage in foreign policy.
So really, the glass ceiling has been broken, and it's just a matter of people coming through it now. Is that really it?
Well, I don't know if I would... it might be overstating it to say that the glass ceiling is broken, because I think that if you look at the general numbers, that there still tend to be many more men in this field of arms control and security issues. But there are certainly some important women leaders.
Obviously, coming up against the old boy network, how do you inveigle in and make those shifts? I mean, obviously, there is pushback, and they don't want to change. How subtle do you have to be, or is it the sledgehammer approach?
I think everybody's experience is different. This generation of women coming in, I think, has some advantage because with gratitude we've had some leaders that have done what was needed in terms of maybe more of a sledgehammer approach. You know, I think now it is a matter of continuing to work in the field to pursue the kind of education and that kind of thing that makes it possible. And one of the key factors is having more young women who are interested in this and can see that they can have a career in this area. And I think that is beginning to happen.
In terms of nuclear disarmament, in terms of globally, obviously one of your focuses is on that and the related peace and security issues. How do you see it going? Where are we now? And is there a real move for disarmament, or is it blocked? Where is it blocked? Can you give us some idea?
Well, I think, you know, it was just last year that we had an important breakthrough. This time last year, we were in the final throes of the Senate consideration of ratifying this new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And that treaty reduced U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear weapons. And it was really, in a relative sense, sort of a modest reduction, but a terribly important treaty because it set forth the ability of us to do on-site inspections in Russia and a way for us to continue further arms control reductions. And sort of really solidified a commitment from both the United States and Russia that was the direction that we're going to head in, and you're bringing these numbers down. And I will say that there needs to be a lot of continued pressure to get that done. And I think there's certainly international demand for that. And in Russia and the United States, I think there's increasing demand for that too. And one of the reasons is that nuclear weapons, we're spending a lot of money on them. And right now we don't have a lot of money to be spending on anything. And so, you know, really, we can't afford to continue what even security experts have called really a Cold War remnant. We have in this country about 5,000 nuclear weapons, and that's, you know, certainly still enough for overkill.
Yeah.
And maintaining those is not it's expensive beyond whether or not it increases our safety one iota.
Right.
So I think that kind of continued pressure is important, and I think with the START treaty, we have a foundation to go to lower numbers, and we need to pursue that. And of course, you know, eventually we need to get beyond just talking to Russia. We need to also be talking to other countries that have nuclear weapons, even though they're much smaller numbers.
Is there another START in the works for the next level, or are they still just resting after the last one?
Well, they're doing there's a lot of data exchanges and information back and forth that are part of the START treaty, which are I think, helpful to us in terms of understanding each other's stockpiles and just the kind of structure of things. And there is interest in further negotiations. I don't think that there's been a lot of serious work done yet on the next level. Internally, the United States had conducted last year a nuclear posture review, and now they need to figure out the sort of brass tack guidance for that. So, you know, the president has stated very clearly that he wants to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, that the goal is to eventually create a safer world without nuclear weapons. Going from where we are now to that goal requires some specific work and change in policy guidance, and that's going on right now within the United States. And again, I think that's a pretty sort of inside secretive process, but it will be helped and furthered by outside pressure, so from real people in the country telling their members of Congress as well as the White House that you know, it's time for us to really move to nuclear disarmament, and that we're tired of spending money on a Cold War remnant.
Do you know approximately how much is spent on the nuclear weapons program?
Well, it is a difficult number to pin down because there's a lot of different little pockets of money where nuclear weapons spending happens. But there are some estimates that have been made that over the next decade we'll spend something like $700 billion on nuclear weapons and related programs like missile defense. We wouldn't likely be developing missile defense but for the fact that we have nuclear weapons. There are a number of other programs that we support, like non-proliferation programs that try to prevent the further spread of nuclear weapons. But those came about because of our spending on nuclear weapons. There's also a vast impact of nuclear weapons production in this country that we're paying for, kind of a sunk cost of nuclear weapons development, the cleanup of a variety of production sites, the compensation of workers who were harmed in the process of nuclear weapons production, even people who were exposed to nuclear weapons testing. So all told, those costs go pretty high, and it's hard to pull them all together. But I think the good news is that there's a lot of money that can be saved by scaling back and not really doing anything terribly dramatically different, but just making it very clear that we don't plan to have the same size nuclear arsenal or growing nuclear arsenal in the middle of the next century. Because right now, the amount of money that we're spending, the programs that we're developing, would enable us to keep this huge nuclear arsenal well into the next century. And I don't think that that's really what the goal is. So if we were to scale back, I think there are some significant savings to be found in the next decade.
If we're at 5,000 now, where were we at the height of the Cold War, and really where should we go down to where it would be the minimum we can have to still protect the country? Where are those two ranges?
It has been much higher, I think, of order in the 10 to 20,000 number at the height of the Cold War.
Wow.
Even coming down to this number, we still have the United States and Russia together 90 to 95% of the world's nuclear arsenal. So it's still We have come down significantly, but it's still a pretty high number. And, there are a variety of different security experts that have come up with different numbers. Some of them say under 500, some have said, 300. And my view, I'm for total nuclear disarmament, so right. I still think that sounds like a lot. But I'd be happy if in the next decade we could make it down to those kinds of lower numbers, hundreds and not the thousands.
Right, that's just a 10% of the amount that we have now, basically. But, it brings up a point when you think of it, all those, we have nuclear subs and nuclear warheads, we think of Fukushima or Three Mile Island as nuclear disasters, but when you think of it, there's a lot of nuclear stuff flying around the world and in all sorts of things. How has that looked at, the protection of that, and how that's disposed of?
I think that that's a really important issue. I mean, that's probably the biggest concern in the 21st century. And we really need to put our focus on how do we contain those materials, isolate them, make sure that they are not materials that terrorists or others can get their hands on and use. One of the ways that we will be able to do that more effectively is by pursuing some of our nuclear disarmament goals. So maintaining these huge arsenals is looked at by other countries as we're not living up to the agreements that we've made to reduce nuclear weapons. And it gives them less of an incentive to participate in efforts to not pursue nuclear weapons themselves or to help to control other countries and to restrain, isolate those countries that are not behaving in a way that helps us to control the spread of nuclear material. So I think that by reducing our nuclear weapons and showing that we are leading on this issue, we can make a big difference. And one of the important things that is happening this year is the follow-on to a summit that happened in 2010 on nuclear security issues. The president hosted here with 47 countries, and this was part of the goal to secure vulnerable nuclear materials around the world within 4 years. And in March, there will be a follow-up conference in Seoul, South Korea, to further that work. And the United States has played a useful and constructive role in that, and I think that's the kind of focus that we need to keep on nuclear weapons and nuclear materials.
Now, obviously, we've got different countries who do have nuclear weapons. Some are friendly to us, some are not. I noticed that the meeting's going to be in South Korea. Obviously, North Korea has nuclear weapons. How do we, in India, Pakistan, there's many countries that are, very independent of America. How are they dealt with by us diplomatically?
Well, I think there's a variety of different approaches, and it kind of depends what country you're talking about. But one thing that is, I would say, universally true is that it helps if the United States can play a role but not be the sole person, not necessarily the sole country trying to restrain a nuclear program. So this is an effort that requires the cooperation of other countries. So I think it's commendable that we've begun to do some of that with nuclear security and nuclear materials. The other thing that occurs to me that I should mention is the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. This is a treaty that would ban all nuclear weapons explosions, and it is a treaty that's really in the United States' advantage. We helped to develop this process, negotiations in the 90s, and then we were the very first country to sign the treaty. But unfortunately, the U.S. Senate has not ratified it. In the meantime, over the past decade, we've had more and more countries signing and ratifying. But that is a treaty that's significant because it really helps to constrain the development of nuclear weapons programs in developing countries. and even for countries like China that have clearly have nuclear weapons programs, it prevents them from making much more sophisticated nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another area where the United States should move forward in a leadership role and ratify the treaty.
Are we working with Israel? I know that's always been a thorny issue, nukes and Israel. Are we working with them at all, or just totally ignoring that issue?
Oh, I don't think that in any sense that we are ignoring Israel on this issue or others. Israel's nuclear stockpile is much smaller than the United States, and I think that probably in this area, leading by example is the most important thing that we can do, figuring out how to reduce our nuclear weapons and to sign on to the treaties and regimes that make a difference.
If you got a bully pulpit, you got to have something behind
right.
you. A recent big thing was the super committee. It failed to come up with a good deficit reduction plan, and that triggered automatic defense cut over the next 10 years. How do you see that, and how are you working with that issue with the military?
One thing that's important to understand is the automatic cuts, the sequestration cuts, have been triggered by the super committee's failure, but they don't actually go into effect until January of 2013. Mm. So there's a year here where we have some time to make cuts, and I think that's the intention of most lawmakers and to really find some serious reductions. Mm-hmm. One thing that has been a bit troubling is the defense industry, and including, the administration's own defense secretary, talking about how these automatic cuts, which fall on both defense spending and then on all of our other domestic discretionary spending, so the things that support education and roads and bridges, all across the board spending, both of those areas have been cut, set up for these automatic cuts.
Oh.
And the Defense Department has been claiming, as well as many of the advocates, that they just simply can't be cut that far. And in reality, those automatic cuts of about $500 or $600 billion would take the Defense Department back to the level of spending that it was doing in fiscal year 2007, after years of growth. So we don't think that those cuts are quite as devastating as they're claiming them to be. If they have their way and, exempt the Defense Department from cuts completely, what will happen is that we will see twice as much impact in all of the other programs that we need in education, in supporting health, Medicaid, all those kinds of things. And those kinds of cuts really, really would be devastating. In this next year, what we think is important is to really look at where some serious cuts could be made in defense spending. And there are a number of areas where we think some very deep cuts could be made and would not in the least bit harm our security. And one of the best examples of that is the nuclear weapons that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. We're not in the Cold War, and we're not in, the Second World War's over, and yet we're still working under that basic premise in the military. Do you have does WAND have a vision, about the, I know we have a necessity to have a military, but how do you see a slim down, just what we need military? What is your vision for that?
You're right that we say that we want to cut the excessive military spending, not that we want to cut everything. We want to have security. We just want it to be smart.
Right.
And we don't claim to have great expertise on exactly what the strategies should be and exactly what the weapon systems should be or the force levels. But we do think that the Pentagon should be looking at that and should be basing its funding on strategy to meet 21st century security needs. And it is very clear that spending money of the amount that we are planning on Cold War nuclear weapons not meeting our 21st century
right.
security needs.
It seems a president can do very little in that respect. Maybe you can nip a bit here, nip a bit there, but you know, is it really a grassroots thing that's going to really make that difference?
Well, I do think that it makes a huge difference. You know, we know that members of Congress throughout the super committee process, it was a huge influx of defense contract lobbyists. Mm. I mean, it was just, it was up on the hill during the time of the super committee deliberations and went to an office of one of the members of the committee.
Yeah.
And I just could not believe, I mean, it was like a circus of lobbyists coming in. And the influence that they have is, you know, the money that they have spent in this is really extreme. And so it's important that real people weigh in. And again, if, you know, people know about the impact in their state. They know that, you know, Medicaid is being cut, that they're not getting the kind of federal dollars that they need, that it's a crushing blow to their state economy.
Mm-hmm.
And they will speak to their members of Congress about that. But what needs to happen is that you also connect the dots to where is the money going and where can we cut and shift some of that money. And that's the thing that we try to communicate because unfortunately it's not readily apparent to a lot of people. And some of the defense industry have really claimed some fairly outrageous things, like that the number of defense jobs cut would be devastating to the economy. Whereas, in fact, we know that if you're going to spend money to create jobs, the defense industry is the worst place to do it. If you look at, economists have looked at different sectors like education and healthcare and even tax cuts. And
yeah.
Spending in those areas creates many more jobs than spending in the military sector.
Why don't we hear that?
Well, it's, I have to say that I think a lot of it does have to do with the very direct interest of some of these weapon system contractors and the amount of money that they're spending.
In other words, they squelch that information basically as
right.
much as possible. No, I think, yeah, those direct relationships between things are so important to give people an idea. Otherwise, you know, you're talking about trillions of dollars. It's meaningless. They need things to hold on to.
Yeah.
Do you go see various Congress politicians? How do you interact with them, and how are you received?
That is part of my job here, is to go up and speak to congressional staff and to members. And one thing that I would say to a lot of, you know, people around the country is that it's not that hard. They really are your elected representative. And people should be more involved in that process, because this is not something that we should be leaving to, you know, the well-heeled lobbyists down here on K Street inside the Beltway.
Does WAND have any big upcoming events or happenings, anything happening we should know about?
Well, you know, we just completed our, in October, our biannual conference where we bring in 125 women state legislators around the country and also some other women community leaders. And we met with all of the members of Congress and also had some great trainings and speaking from the State Department and others. So that was our big event, and the next one won't come around until September of 2013. But we are continuing to do work, and our next big push of work is when the budget comes out in February for fiscal year 2013. And we'll be looking at that budget to see what portion is going to the Defense Department and to military spending. And we annually send to Congress a letter asking them to look at that budget and to shift the budget priorities and figure out how we can support a smarter defense budget and also find a way to support the other programs that are much needed and getting cut.
Can people tap into that conference? Do you have it up somewhere on your website?
Yes, our website is really easy. It's www.wand, like the magic wand.org, and we have information about our conference and about all the things that we're doing.
Well, thank you, Kathy Robinson of WAND.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it very much, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.